Great, well, let's make a start. I'll just give everyone a chance just to grab a seat. And here's the question. You've got 4 weeks on God. It's a pretty good topic. You've been given week number one. Where do you start? There are all sorts of things we could focus in on about God, about his character, about his love, his gentleness, his holiness. But tonight, week number one, we're going to go for what on the surface seems like a very simple point. A simple point, but a crucial point. We're going to be thinking about the bigness of God, the bigness of God. I'm sure there's all sorts of theological words to describe this. Ask Charlie about them afterwards, but I think just as helpful is to talk about the bigness of God. God is big, very impressive, and it would be really helpful for us if we can get a better understanding of that. Let me say up front, we won't leave here tonight with a perfectly correct view of God, because God is incomprehensibly big, too much for humans to fully grasp. But my prayer has been that we get closer to that this evening. And our key verse, Charlie said, we're looking at key verses. So our key verse this evening is in Isaiah chapter 40. And in this key verse, we see where Isaiah expects his hearers to be at with their understanding of this truth, their understanding of God's bigness. So it's Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 28. Isaiah 40 verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. And Isaiah doesn't expect this to be a new truth to them. Ever since they were toddlers in the temple kids club, these guys have been taught this truth. God is big. But he expects them to forget it, to not really believe it, and therefore not to live it out. Have you not known? Have you not heard? And he's writing to a people in a particular historical situation, a particularly tough time where, without making any excuses for them, it's kind of understandable why they're starting to forget just how big God is. We're thinking more about their situation in a bit, but it's not just for them. We are definitely prone to the same danger. We've been taught about God. We know that he's big, but we often forget just how big he is. And so the plan is to spend the first half of our time using this verse and using the verses around it to correct and refocus our view of God. In the world of photography, we're going to be putting on the wide-angle camera lens in the hope that we capture more of the incredible bigness and vastness and scale and power of our God. And then once we've done that, we're going to spend the rest of our time asking how in particular Isaiah thinks that this particular truth about God will encourage us. Why is it so brilliant that God is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth, one who will never faint or grow weary? So first, the wide-angle lens. I've been on a summer camp recently teaching through John's Gospel. I spent quite a lot of time in preparation trying to come up with illustrations that will help the kids understand the points being made. It's campers, so we went pretty wacky, and we had campers come up with a 15-second sales pitch, a door-to-door sales pitch, for a Compare the Market meerkat. We had a story of someone getting taken down by White House security. We had a man in the sea ducking under the waves in order to escape from his rescuers. And we had Danny, the champion of the world, being taught how to poach pheasants by his father. All obviously really, really helpful illustrations for understanding John's Gospel. But here in Isaiah, there was no need to sit down and think, how can I illustrate the fact that God is everlasting and the creator of the ends of the earth? How can I really help everyone grasp that truth? Because Isaiah is a master illustrator. Now, if Leonardo da Vinci is the master of painting pictures with oils, well then Isaiah is his equal when it comes to painting pictures with words. And in the 15 or so verses before that summary, in verse 28, Isaiah gives us a whole stack of images that are designed to expand our thinking and inflate, blow up our view of God so that we really get the magnitude of what he's saying. And he does it in the form of a series of questions, questions where we don't need to be given the answer, because when you start to think about it, it's really obvious. So look back, if you will, to chapter 40, verse 12. Isaiah says this, he asks this question: who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? It's a brilliant image to help us realize just how big God is. So think about the last time you're at the seaside and you're looking out to sea. Recall that view. Water is stretching out to the horizon. I did that a couple of weeks ago in Dorset. It was a stunning view, this great expanse of water. And yet, actually, I was just looking across the sea to France. When it comes down to it, the English Channel is a pretty minor player in terms of oceans and seas. There are ocean floors out there that we don't even know what lives on it because it's so deep down. So have that image in your mind, and then take a look at your hand. Don't cheat and use both hands. Just one is permitted. And then pick up your cup of water. Now, this is an optional activity. You don't have to do it, but I'd recommend it for illustrative purposes. Maybe you want to do it kind of over a plate or something like that. So look at your hand, pick up your cup of water, and see how much water you can get into the palm of your hand. Are people doing it? It is a pretty pitiful amount, a pretty pitiful amount. We, probably between us, we could just about drain a small fishbowl, I reckon. But God, well, God has measured all the lakes and all the seas and all the oceans in the palm of his hand. God is big. This obviously isn't a scientific statement, it's poetic. God is spirit. He doesn't have physical hands. But it's an accurate statement. God is on that kind of scale, mind-blowingly big. Give your wet left hand a rest and stretch out your right hand. Look at the distance between the tip of your thumb and the tip of your little finger. I measured mine earlier, 22 centimetres. I reckon my hands are probably on the large end of the scale. Well, what about God? Well, the next bit in verse 12 tells us that God marked off the heavens with a span. Just like that, one span of his hand, the entire universe. You should always be careful quoting facts about subject areas that you're ignorant about, and science is one of them for me. But apparently people estimate, who knows how, but people estimate that the universe is 93 billion light years across. And a light year apparently is about 6 trillion miles. So 93 billion times 6 trillion miles, one span of God's hands. Douglas Adams, he famously wrote in A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, "Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space." And Isaiah is saying to us, God is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big he is. I mean, you may think it's a long way to the other side of the universe, but that is just peanuts to God. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? And of course, we see in these verses not just the bigness of God in comparison to everything around us, but also that God was the one who created it all. So God designed the Himalayas and those slopes that you ski down in the Alps. God sculpted cycling's Box Hill and sailing's Weymouth Bay. And God did it without any help or advice. So look at verse 13. Who has measured the spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult, and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Hundreds of people were involved in the design of the Olympic velodrome. There were architects, engineers, scientists. Apparently, even Sir Chris Hoy chipped in with advice about how close the crowd should be and how to stop airflow through spectator doors and the need for competitor toilets in the middle of the cycling track. And the result of all these people's contributions was an architectural and sporting masterpiece. But God, well, he didn't need any advice or help when he was creating the ultimate masterpiece, that is the world. He didn't need committees and think tanks and test events. He's always existed. He's everlasting. And his understanding and wisdom are everlasting too. God has never been in the dark about anything. He's never confused by what might be the best course of action. He's never in need of a quiet word of advice. God knows exactly what to do, always. So we've got some brilliant truths here. But reality is, we don't really believe them all the time. Why don't we believe them? After all, they're really good things to believe. It would benefit us to believe them, so why don't we? I think the big problem for us in really believing these truths is that we live by what we can see. We live by what is tangible. As an example, we are often impressed by the natural world around us, the oceans and the mountains and the stars. They're big and impressive. And then we move to London and, well, the beautiful creation isn't quite as tangible unless concrete's your thing. But even in London, when we watch that Attenborough documentary, or when we manage to escape town on a clear night and see the Milky Way, well, we're reminded again, we see just how impressive creation is. We live by what we see. What about humans? Humans, I think, seem pretty impressive to us because we're slap bang in the middle of a society that glorifies human achievements, whether it's in sport or academia or entertainment or in humanitarian acts. We're constantly being given examples of wonderful human beings doing wonderful things. And so we think humans are impressive. We live by what we see. But we never see God. And so that automatically makes him less impressive in our minds. Subconsciously, he becomes smaller and smaller. We might spend a whole day where we hardly think about God as we watch human impressiveness at the Olympics or enjoy the beauty of creation on our summer holidays. And so we need to feast on passages like this, verses like this, where our eyes are lifted to see God as he really is. It's not meant as a beat-up passage, this. It's not trying to make us feel bad. Not at all. Rather, it's imploring us not to miss out, not to live day by day without this realistic, accurate, big view of God. So when we're awestruck by the natural world around us, which is an absolutely okay way to feel, Isaiah wants us to use that to remember how big and impressive God is. Well, he marked off the heavens with a span. When we're impressed by human achievements, he wants us to use that to remember how big and impressive God is. And so look on to verses 15 to 17. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. When you fill up a saucepan, a few drops of water don't make it in. You don't even notice. When you're baking that cake, some grains of flour stay on the weighing scales. The cake tastes no different for it. That is how small whole nations are in comparison to God's. The whole of China, inconsequently small in comparison to God. And so that will be a helpful thing to remember when we see Usain Bolt proclaim himself as a living legend to worldwide acclaim. And I guess Usain could have had anything he wanted on London last Thursday night after his 200-metre victory, got into any place he wanted to go, hung out with whoever he pleased. A really impressive man. But compared to God, well, he's nothing. If nations are like the drop from a bucket, well, then a single man is infinitesimally small. Like I said, I don't think this passage is primarily out to knock people like Usain Bolt back down to size. It's not saying either that God doesn't care about us because we're so insignificant. Rather, it's saying, think of the most impressive human being you know, or the most impressive nation, and then realize just how big and impressive your God is in comparison. Now, there's a bit about idols in verses 18 to 20, and I think even that is doing this positive slant. And it's kind of saying, some of you choose to worship an insignificant created thing instead of the mighty creator God. How ridiculous. Do you not see that? It's laughable. It's pitiful. You must have such a skewed, small view of God if you'd resort to that. Do yourself a favor. Stop wasting your time and return to God. And this passage goes on. It has stacks more brilliant images that we don't have time to go into in depth now. It reminds us God is the one who is, even today, exerting powerful rule over creation. He's the one who brings princes to nothing. He blows on them, and that's it. They wither away. He knows all the stars by name and calls them out each night. And so that repeated question we get through this passage, with whom will you compare God? Well, Isaiah doesn't answer it directly, but he makes the answer very clear. God is incomparable. Our God is infinitely bigger, more powerful, more wise. And so once we've been through the passage and we arrive back at verse 28, our key verse, well, I think we're better equipped to understand just what it's saying. Like I said, not that we're now having a completely accurate view of God. God's size is going to be incomprehensible to us. But hopefully, within the limits of our human minds, well, we have a bigger, a wide-angle view of God. Hopefully, we can grasp the magnitude of that statement. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. The Lord is big. And we're going to spend a little bit of time in groups now. So if you look on your sheets, at the bottom there is a box with a couple of questions. Questions about how we normally view God day to day, and why we think that is. And then a question to get us thinking about how we can help ourselves and each other to have this bigger, more accurate view of God. So we'll give you about 10 or so minutes to chat through these. Okay, we're gonna draw together again there. Well, if we just ended here, I hope have been a really helpful evening, and we'd have gone away with a bigger view of God. But we can take this further, because as with all the Bible, Isaiah isn't just saying, here, know this about God. He's saying, here, know this about God into a particular situation. A particular situation where this truth will be especially helpful. Will be especially helpful to know that God is big. So we need to ask, what is the original situation where Isaiah first spoke these words? And then we need to use that to work out how this will help us today. And the two key things to note from the historical context. So first, God has just made some awesome promises to his people. If you aren't very familiar with Isaiah, I commend the earlier chapters to you, and they're well worth a read. God has promised his people a wonderful future. He's promised that they would live in a prosperous city with God in their midst. There would be peace. There would be righteousness. There would be restored relationships. Death would be no more. All the nations would flock there, wanting a piece of the action. It's worth just looking at one bit briefly. So if you just flick back to Isaiah 25. I'm just going to read from Isaiah 25, verse 6. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. And the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. Awesome promises to his people. But then secondly, reality was that the nations were flocking to Jerusalem for a very different piece of the action. They were coming in war to burn and to pillage. So first Syria and some old friends, the northern kingdom of Israel, had attacked them. And then swiftly on their heels, Assyria trashed the land and laid siege to Jerusalem. God spectacularly brought that threat to an end. But almost immediately, as you'll find in chapter 39, it was announced that Babylon would come. And Babylon would come and complete the job by carting everyone who was left off into exile. Judah would have felt like the proverbial Middle Eastern pincushion, with everyone having a go at sticking their sword in. So they've got great promises for the future, but great present suffering. And so God's people, they give voice to their feelings. It's there in verse 27 of chapter 40. In this situation, this is what God's people say. My way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. My way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. Now, they speak out of despair. They've reached the end of their tether. God is not going to help us. He's forgotten about us. He doesn't even seem to care. News is reaching us of the powerful Babylonian army in the hinterlands. Their advance is relentless. It doesn't seem like anything can stop them. Gone are the days where God helped us. Or imagine a couple of generations later as God's people are languishing in exile in Babylon. Well, we may as well stop telling the stories about Moses and King David and the glory days when God helped to make us great. Things have changed. We'll never see Jerusalem again. God isn't going to help us. At which point, Isaiah begs to differ. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? You're wrong. You don't need to despair. The Lord will help you. He has not forgotten about you. He does care. Now, I wonder what fact about God you would have chucked in at this point to convince the despairing masses. Maybe God always keeps his promises. God is trustworthy. God has saved you in the past. Isaiah goes for, have you not heard? Have you not known? The Lord you're doubting is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He, the one you think is unable to help, does not faint or grow weary. His understanding, the one you think hasn't got a clue about what's going on, is unsearchable. You see, God's people, they receive promises in the form of words, but now they're going through an experience that seems contrary to what's been said, and so they've concluded that they can no longer trust the promise. It's mere words. God must have been a bit too optimistic with what he thought he could achieve. But they've come to that conclusion without the right view of the God who made the promises. They've forgotten that he is the everlasting God. They've forgotten he's the creator of the ends of the earth. They've forgotten that he is far bigger than they could ever comprehend. And that makes all the difference. Because if they had the right view of God, well, they'd realize it is impossible for him to faint or to grow weary. Now, he's the one who made everything and keeps everything going. He's not like his creation. He doesn't get tired. The whole world would have fallen apart long ago if that was the case. And therefore, their situation cannot have come about because he's lost control or he's run out of steam. That's impossible with God. Let me tell you about myself. I ride a scooter around town. It's a great mode of transport, much quicker than the tube or the bus, much more enjoyable. But my little Vespa is getting a little bit old. So 24,500 miles on the clock, 12 years of faithful service to me and many others before me. So say I said I'm going to meet you at 9:30 in the morning. You're a 10-minute drive away. And so I leave my flat at 9:20, go down to the garage, turn the ignition, and all I get is a whirring noise. The engine refuses to start. This has started to happen to me. Because the bike has got old and weary, well, I'm not going to be able to keep my word to you. Despite my best intentions, I'm not going to be there at 8:30. A weary bike equals a broken promise. Whereas our big God will never grow faint or never grow weary. And so if he's made a promise to us, there is nothing that can stop him following through with it. And so God's people, well, they should have trusted that he knew just what he was doing in their present hardship. Isaiah's message to them, his big message to them in the middle of the mess, in the pit of despair, is remember just how big your God is and therefore wait for him to do as he's promised. And that phrase, waiting for the Lord there in verse 31, I think it can seem a bit of a strange concept to us. There's some fairly odd ideas out there about what it means. So we sing that song, don't we? Strength will rise as we wait upon the Lord. It's a great song. It's straight out of these verses. But I wonder if we really know what we're singing when we sing it. And so people often think we're singing, strength will rise as I wait for the Lord to give me some fresh input and advice about what to do next. As if you're really quiet and really patient, then God will reward you with some extra information that you need to get through the next bit of life. But that doesn't fit with the order in which we're told things will happen, does it? It's strength will rise as I wait. Not strength will rise after I've waited and then receive the advice that I need. And so waiting on the Lord isn't to receive new information. That definitely wouldn't help strengthen you when you're in the pit of despair and God seems very distant and no new information is forthcoming. No, waiting upon the Lord is waiting on the promises that God has already made in his revealed words and being absolutely convinced that's a worthwhile thing to do, that he will do as he said, because you have a right view of just how big he is. It's saying, I'm content to sit and wait patiently, even in this mess, because I know the Lord will come true in his words. He doesn't faint or grow weary. Nothing can stop him doing as he said he will. So I'll wait. What would it look like for strength to rise in those Israelites in Babylon waiting on the Lord? Well, they wouldn't despair. Rather, they'd be confident despite their situation, knowing they had a God to whom Babylon was like a drop out of a bucket. They'd stand firm as his people, trusting that exile would come to an end, just as he's promised. And not in just a passive sense either, I don't think. Waiting upon the Lord leads to actions. So we think of waiting as sitting at a bus stop for 10 minutes, idling away time. But waiting on the Lord to fulfill his promises, well, it should be an active thing. Isaiah here describes people who wait on the Lord as runners, as people who run as athletes. They're active. So take for example, and within the context of the exile, take Daniel and his friends. Daniel, big character of the Old Testament. They would have been at risk, just like everyone else, of being like that youth who faints and grows weary and falls exhausted and stops following the God of the universe. But brilliantly, because they knew the everlasting God, because they had a big view of him, they knew they could trust his promises. Well, they were strengthened. And so for them, waiting looked like acting incredibly boldly, honoring God in the face of awful opposition, and even being prepared to go to the burning furnace and the lion's den, still speaking about him. They knew their big God. They were strengthened. Their waiting was active. And there's not much different to be said for how this then applies to us. So we've been with the guys in Babylon. How does this apply to us? Well, we too are called to wait confidently upon the Lord, the one who doesn't faint or grow weary. His promises might just be words, but they're still absolutely valid in 2012, because he is a big God. Except actually, we're in an even stronger position. And the promises of Isaiah about the heavenly city that they were to wait for, well, they've been elaborated on even more in the New Testament. We've got even more to help us get excited as we wait. And we have even more reason to be sure that actually we will be there one day, because God has invested the death of his son in it. Since Isaiah's time, God himself has come to the earth as the Lord Jesus, displayed his power over creation, and then died as a fulfillment of so many Old Testament promises. The way is now fully open to enter God's righteous city and live alongside him through Jesus' death that took away our sin. Now that he's done that, well, there's only one thing left on God's to-do list. Get the party started. That's the only thing left. And so if Daniel could wait so confidently in exile, when there was so much for God to still do, when the big problem of sin still hadn't been dealt with, well, surely we can wait confidently now with the finish line in sight. You may have never felt all-out despair about your chances of getting to heaven, but some people will. And we'll all have moments where we doubt whether God is really in control of our circumstances, or where we're incredibly aware of our weaknesses and feel unable to keep going. And so what a wonderful promise at the end of this passage. They who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. God does not faint. And so he has the ability to strengthen his people so they don't faint either. I hope we all want to be confident going for it Christians who do great things for the kingdom of God. Well, for starters, we need to make sure we maintain a big view of God. Now, the strong Christian doesn't look for comfort in themselves or their circumstances. They found comfort in their big God, who is absolutely able to do all that he's promised. Lose this right view of God, and we start to lose our assurance. Have this right view of God. Keep cultivating it. And we'll be enabled to keep going as Christians. Serve the gospel in all sorts of ways. Until we reach the wonderful heavenly city. We're going to go back into our groups now. The plan is to go a step further in applying this to ourselves. So the New Testament, it picks up quite a lot on this language of waiting. And applies it to the Christian. So I've put some references in your sheet, and the idea is look them up, and then once you've established what it is the New Testament says we're still waiting for, it will be helpful to ask what might stop us trusting these promises, what might stop us waiting, and then to use the truth of God's bigness to combat these doubts. And it'd be good to aim to leave a good 10 minutes at the end to pray around your tables as well. And I think Charlie is then going to get up about 8:10. So we've got just over 20 minutes now to chat and then to pray.